We're going to get started because we've got a full hour of interviews today. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk to two people. Peter Singer is up first, and we talked to him earlier this week about his new book, What We Eat and Why Our Food Choices Matter. Peter Singer, if you don't know, is, I guess you could say he was the godfather of the animal rights movement with the publication of his book, Animal Liberation, in 1975.
Yeah.
One of the more outspoken and articulate vegetarians.
Teaches at Princeton.
Mm-hmm. And
he was up in San Francisco at the time and on his way back home to Australia.
Mm-hmm.
Your book is The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. And we discover very early on in the book that it's really about meat. Why meat? Why not oranges or pecans?
Although I don't think the book is only about meat. I mean, it's also about the choice of organic rather than conventional, and obviously that relates to produce and many other things. It's also about fair trade products, and I don't think there's any meat that I'm aware of that's a fair trade product. It's also about buying locally, and that, of course, includes a lot more than meat. So, you know, while meat is a very central part of the American diet, and in terms of its impact on the planet, it has a larger impact, I think, and of course it has a larger impact on animals than anything else we eat. I do see the book as broader than being about meat.
So if you could sum up, then what is that broader project that you're trying to get at with this book?
Well, it's to really make food into an ethical issue. I know that your program is called The Politics of Food. I suppose I could call my book The Ethics of Food. In fact, mm-hmm. it's about to appear in Australia under the title The Ethics of What We Eat, which was my original working title. Rodale didn't like it. They thought that term ethics was going to put off some readers. But
well, it is scary.
That is, yes, you find it scary too? Well, maybe Rodale were right for the American market. We'll see how it does in Australia. But that's how I think of it. You know, I think we tend not to think of food as an ethical issue. You know, we think of sex as an ethical issue. We think of taking bribes as an ethical issue. You know, there's a range of other things. But food generally doesn't come into it. So I'd like to change that, and I'd like to get people to think about the ethical implications of all their possible food choices.
Where do you start, you know, as an ethicist when looking at food?
Well, I start, because of the kind of ethics that I hold, I start looking at the consequences of those choices. So when we go into the supermarket and buy something, or when we order something in a restaurant, you have to say, you know, you're supporting some form of production by that purchase. Now, what are the implications of that? How was it produced? What was the impact of its production on the environment, on workers perhaps, on animals, if we're talking about an animal product? So it's trying to say, how can we have the most positive impact and avoid the most negative impacts in our food choices?
And as a consumer, what does the first step look like? That's, you know, because we're bombarded with information like this.
Well, you know, we're bombarded with information, but it's actually quite hard to get information about where our food comes from.
Exactly.
So the first step really for us was to try and dig a little deeper and look at these products and find out where they do come from and describe the systems, the agricultural systems that led to them. And that's, you know, an important part of the book. And, of course, one of the discoveries we then had was that it's actually quite difficult to do this, and that the big corporations don't want to let you see how they produce food. In particular, they don't want to let you see how animals are reared in modern American factory farms.
Now, you take three tacks in your book, and you do that by looking at three different broad ways of eating. Can you
That's
tell us
right.
what those are?
Yes, sure. Yes. Well, we do it by looking at three families. We thought it would be interesting to follow three families with different kinds of dietary choices and look at how their products come from. So our first family eats what we call the standard American diet. That is, they go to Walmarts, they take their shopping cart along the aisles, they throw in what, you know, looks to them like it's going to taste good, what they can afford, what's going to be convenient to prepare. And when they take the family out, they go to one of the major fast food chains and eat there. So that's the standard American diet. Then the second family we call the conscientious omnivores. They eat a wide range of food, including meat, fish, dairy, and eggs. But they don't just pick them up from anywhere where they're cheap. They try to get organically produced food. If they can, they'll buy locally. They live in Connecticut and have a local farmer they buy some food from. They will also...
So there's a tribe of conscientious omnivores in Connecticut.
Well, there's certainly some of them, yes.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, they will look for information about the animal welfare implications. So if there's a label, certified humane, that they look for, which they believe provides them with better animal welfare. And then the third family, which is the sort of, I guess, the one most different of all from the standard American diet, is a vegan family. They don't eat any animal products at all, they also look for organically produced products. They're particularly keen to avoid genetically modified foods, but in general they support organic methods of production.
Where do you fall within those three categories? Are you strict vegan?
Well, I'm a vegan, but not a strict one. I think
okay.
That's probably the best way of saying
when,
it.
When's the last time you've had meat?
Oh, the last time I had meat?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if we're not talking about occasions when you're traveling and the language isn't clear and you think that you've made it clear that you don't want the soup if it has meat in it, but in fact, you know, after you've eaten some of the vegetable soup, a little bit of meat floats up in your spoon.
That doesn't count.
That doesn't count?
Yeah.
Okay, in that case, you would have to say... 35 years ago, that's when I became a vegetarian.
Well, and for people who are listening who don't know, you're the author of Animal Liberation of 1975.
That's correct, yes.
And have your views changed in terms of animal rights and meat consumption in these 30 years?
They haven't changed in any fundamental way. You know, some of my friends in the animal movement might say I've become a bit soft in my more mature years because... I suppose I might be more tolerant of someone like the conscientious omnivores, at least if they are really conscientious and they really check up that the animals have had a good life and have not just been trucked off to any old slaughterhouse to be killed, but maybe were killed on the farm. I mean, if people you know, feel that they can't give up meat and they think as long as the animal had a decent life, that's a reasonable compromise, I'm not going to be too heavy on them. I think that they are doing their best to try and work out an ethical position that they can live with, even though, you know, that's not what I would do myself.
In the history of meat consumption by humans, do you think that has changed over the last 30 years? You know, why now with this book?
Well, why now? Because, you know, Jim Mason and I, my co-author with this book, had a book called Animal Factories, which was published in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
And it did okay, but nothing spectacular. And after a few years, it was allowed to go out of print. And Jim and I were talking about that a few years back, and we thought, you know, maybe this book was a little bit ahead of its time, because there wasn't very much discussion about food and where it came from then. Even the animal rights movement in America was very much focused on the use of animals in research rather than the use of animals for food.
Mm-hmm.
And then we noticed that was changing. The animal movement is now more focused on food animals, I think quite rightly, because the numbers are vastly greater.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been more discussion also of the effect of factory farms on on the Midwest, on rural areas, the depopulation that occurs, the fact that small independent farmers have more or less been put out of business. All of those issues we felt were now starting to get more attention, and therefore perhaps it was time for another book that addressed these issues now.
So in this book, am I reading you correctly that you would place these three broad approaches to eating on sort of a sliding scale of ethics?
Yes, that is correct. I think we do think that the sort of the vegan family that also looks for organic food is the one that's probably doing best of all. But I guess I would also say that I think the gap between the standard American diet and the conscientious omnivores is a much larger gap than the gap between the conscientious omnivores and the vegans. So that's why I say if people feel that they can't quite see themselves giving up meat, they should know that they're taking a huge step to minimize the harmful effects of what they're doing if they move to avoiding factory farm products. That's in a way, you know, if there's a single soundbite from this book, the takeaway message as to what consumers should do to eat more ethically, it would be avoid factory farm products.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of factors are you looking at to determine how ethical someone is eating?
I suppose the major factors we're looking at are environmental. Is this sustainable? What is it doing to the planet, both in the sense of contributing to climate change on the large scale and also locally? Well, locally as what it does to the immediate neighborhood, and also in medium range, I guess, is what it does to the rivers, and ultimately maybe flows down the Mississippi, what it does to the Gulf of Mexico. So those are important factors. Then the impact on animals is certainly an important thing, I believe. I think that we need to consider what we're doing to animals to live and eat ethically. And thirdly, we look at questions about workers and sort of social justice issues. How are workers treated in this industry? Do they have satisfactory working conditions? Are they able to bargain collectively for improving them? Those sorts of things.
I'm going to jump ahead in the future a little bit here. Probably a lot here, actually. Growing meat. Right now, to grow meat, in other words, to grow it in the laboratory, is cost prohibitive. In fact, they're just beginning to look into this. But do you look at that as something that would be ethically all right, or just the idea that it's a meat product? Is that a no-no?
No, there's nothing wrong with eating meat in itself. Mm-hmm. So we don't object to that. We do have a little discussion of that, in fact, towards the end, and you're absolutely right. It's too costly at the moment. But if you could grow meat and cell by cell, just by taking some cells from meat and growing them in culture so that they multiplied, and you had something that was biochemically meat and tasted exactly like meat, was exactly as nourishing as meat, but had never been part of a sentient being, so there was no suffering, and if we assume also that it was produced in an ecologically sustainable way, and it obviously could avoid a lot of the inputs that you have to have with real meat, so it could be a more efficient way of producing food, then I don't have any problems with it. There's nothing wrong with meat per se. There's only lots of things wrong with the way in which it's produced.
We think that would be a good weaning process to get people off of eating real meat. Is it a way to fool people to be more ethical? Is that ethical?
Yeah, of course, we already have a lot of pretty good substitutes. We have Boca Burgers and fake chicken things and all the rest of it, and some of those are quite tasty and nourishing and quite economical. So there are, in fact, alternatives, and they've been around for a while. In fact, when my wife and I became vegetarians, some 35 years ago, there was already some kind of textured vegetable protein that we used just as a transitional thing, because we had all these recipes for dishes that used ground beef or something, and we wanted to keep using them. So after a while, we found better things to eat. Mm-hmm. But I think for people who want to make that transition slowly, meat grown in the lab could be an excellent way of doing it.
But doesn't a Boca Burger still occupy agricultural land as well? Can you talk about the distinction you make between land used for plant production and for animal production?
Right. Well, of course, Boca Burger does occupy agricultural land. Almost anything that we eat, unless we hunt or gather mushrooms, will occupy agricultural land. But the point is that when we eat meat, the cattle or pigs or whatever it is that we're eating, chickens, are being fed on grain that has been grown on agricultural land. And in the mere process of harvesting it and feeding it to these animals, and the animals then have to burn energy in order to keep their bodies warm to produce things that we don't eat, like bone and so on, in that process we lose most of the food value of the corn or soy or whatever it is that we've grown. In fact, it depends a bit on the species. In the case of cattle, we probably lose something like 9/10 of the food value of what we've grown. In the case of chicken, we maybe only lose 2/3 of it, but we're losing most of it either way. So if we eat the plant products directly, we're actually having a less heavy footprint on the planet, because we don't need as much agricultural land to feed ourselves.
Is that loss partially an artifact of the way that we use these animals? I mean, throughout human history, it hasn't always been that way, that we just strip off the meat parts and chuck the rest and have to deal with the waste.
That's true. Of course, we've made use in the past of bone and skins and so on. But the other big difference between what we've done in the past with animals and what we're doing now is that in the past we used animals to gather and concentrate food that we could not eat. So we had cattle. We grazed them on grasslands. We can't eat grass. We don't have the stomachs to digest grass, but they do. So they, under their own steam, you might say, using their own leg power, went out and gathered this food. And then when we killed them and ate them, we had the benefit of additional food to our diet that we couldn't otherwise have had. And, you know, we couldn't grow crops on this grassland. It wasn't suitable for crop growing. But now that we take the animals off the grassland, in most cases, of course, you can still get some grass-fed beef and if you look very hard, but most of us come from feedlot-reared beef or intensively reared pigs or chickens. We're taking the animals off the land. They no longer gather the food. We have to grow it for them. We have to harvest it, transport it to them. And that's why we're getting less food value than we're actually putting into them.
So would you say that are we in a different ethical situation than, say, a hunter-gatherer?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, that's one of the principles of the book. We develop five principles of ethics towards the end of the book that we talk about, and one of them is this principle of need, that need can justify things that a mere desire for the taste of something or to, you know, continue a habit doesn't justify. So if someone is living a traditional hunter-gatherer lifestyle, maybe the Inuit in the north or in Australia, where I'm originally from, there are still some Australian Aboriginals living this kind of lifestyle, and they go out and hunt and gather. They need that protein in order to survive, at least to survive in those areas, and to continue to live that lifestyle. So that makes a big difference to the ethics of it. I think I'm certainly not criticizing them for hunting, but when we aren't living that kind of lifestyle and we have a choice of a wide range of nourishing foods that we could get, we're choosing the meat simply because we like its taste, and that obviously can't justify as much as if we really needed it.
Peter Singer, can you talk about this utilitarian idea that you've expressed in your writing before, that the greatest good for the greatest number is an ethic that we should look toward?
Right. The greatest good for the greatest number is a kind of quick shorthand slogan for what utilitarians are talking about, and some people think that this means that, you know, the majority always prevails, and therefore, you know, if the crowd enjoys watching the Christians thrown to the lions, then it's good to throw the Christians to the lions. This is not what we mean. We're talking about the greatest net good, so the fact that 10,000 people, you know, have a slight preference for watching Christians thrown to the lions rather than watching a football game won't override the fact that the Christians have an extremely strong preference for not being thrown to the lions. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of you have to look at all of the pros and cons, all of the good and bad things that happen as a result of an action. You have to weigh them for the intensity of suffering or the severity of pain, and in that way, you try to work out what is going to have the best consequences. It's obviously a rough guide. You can't always calculate this very precisely, but in some cases, I think it does give you a reasonably clear answer.
Where I'm going with that is that I'm curious what your thoughts are on when we're talking about the greatest good for the greatest number of people, and you apply that to, say, a calculation of land use productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, that land, though, is still used for us as a species. And doesn't that still reflect a speciesism?
Well, as I was saying, I think that where we are doing things that are necessary for our survival, we can justify that. Now, you might say, well, it's perhaps necessary for the survival of non-human animals as well, and I certainly think that they can't, and I think that we should therefore, as I say, consume as lightly as we can and allow as much land for wildlife, for the animals that are native to it, as we possibly can. But I don't think we have an obligation to basically commit suicide by not growing food. I think our interests can too, and I can't see that there's any reason why they can't less than the interests of other animals. There might be some arguments as to why we get more out of our life, we can get greater benefit out of our lives in some ways. That's debatable. But in any case, I think that certainly our claims go into the balance, and as long as we're trying to minimize the harm that we're inflicting on them, I think we're justified in doing what we need to do to continue to feed ourselves.
An extension of that question is, I guess, just the ethics of the sheer size of the human population. Is it ethical to sustain their numbers where we are, whether we feed them cheesy puffs or corn dogs? How does scale enter into this ethical equation?
Well, we're certainly, the fact that we have 6.5 billion people is certainly putting strains on the planet and is dispossessing, animals in wild areas. And it's also, I think, likely to be very bad for us because if indeed all of the 6.5 billion is to aspire to live at the level of us in the United States or people in developed countries generally, then I think we're going to have a bigger ecological disaster than we seem to be heading for already. So I do think that population is a major issue, and we ought to be doing something to make sure that it basically tops out, that the upward curve tops out as soon as possible. The population experts are telling us that they think it probably will top out somewhere in the middle of this century, but we've got to make sure that happens or happens earlier if possible. Because, yes, I do think that this is a major ethical issue. Whether we can actually reduce the population...
Right, whether we can or not is a different question.
A different question from whether we ought to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, if you're asking whether we ought to, it's difficult. I would say that if we could have 6 billion people living good lives, there is a lot that's valuable in that. And it would be hard to say that you would... have more value, that you would have greater benefits if you had fewer people and more animals and more wilderness, assuming that those 6 billion were living in a sustainable way, of course, which is certainly not the case at the moment.
Well, speaking of sustainable, you spend a good deal of time in your book really scrutinizing that idea of sustainable, which I think is important. In fact, dedicate a couple of pages to Michael Pollan, who we've had on just a couple of weeks ago on the politics of food. Mm-hmm. And he is a fan of Polyface Farm,
right?
And which is run by Joel Salatin. But you found out some things that go on behind the sustainable label. Can you talk about that?
Well, we were concerned, with Polyface, particularly, I guess, in terms of some of the animal welfare aspects. That is that his chickens, not the egg-laying chickens, but the ones he sells for meat, are in fact really in a kind of wire cages. One person has described the system as a kind of battery cage or a broiler shed cage with a grass floor, because they're in cages that are in a field and they're dragged along behind a tractor so that they're not always on the same bit of grass. And that's not much of an existence, we think, for the chickens. They're confined, they're not really protected from the sun, and they can be quite stressed by this system. We also had some problems with the slaughter method that is used on farm for some of the animals, and it didn't show really the kind of real concern for animal welfare that you would expect from a farm that Michael Pollan was really lauding to the skies in his description.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very problematic, and as a self, I'll out myself, I'm a conscientious omnivore.
Right.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Michael Pollan. Do you think a label such as sustainable or any type of label, does it ultimately function to our benefit, or does it sort of distract us from what's really going on?
It's difficult to find rules for what you're going to count as sustainable. I think that's part of the problem. The current organic label has reasonably specific rules, so it's pretty clear what it means, although in fact, as we investigated in the book, particularly with dairy products, where it seems to say that cows have to be on pasture, there's been some question as to how that's compatible with the existence of some of these 5,000 cow
exactly.
organic dairies.
Right.
So there is a real issue with its interpretation on that particular point. I'm hoping that the U.S. Department of Agriculture is going to clear that up within the next few months and rule that these dairies are not organic and that the rules mean what they say, that cows have to be on pasture to have organic milk. But generally, you know, the rules are the kind that you can at least imagine being clarified and enforced. But if you have a label that says sustainably produced, that's much more difficult to interpret. Mm-hmm. I mean, what exactly does that mean? If you import fossil fuels into the farm, if you're using oil, for example, I mean, it's clear that mm-hmm. that oil use is not sustainable. It's limited. Mm-hmm. Many people think it's already peaked. So if you're using, if you're bringing oil onto the farm, you could argue that the farm is not sustainable. And obviously, Joel Salatin is doing that to power his tractors and so on.
Well, I think that the label shows up because it's apparent that that's what consumers want to believe about the product.
Right.
So it's almost, I mean, and obviously, you know, we're all in this position where I think when it comes to actually consuming it, it's more important for us to believe that it's true for
yes.
than for it to actually be true.
right, yes. Actually, one of the funniest things about Michael Pollan's book, speaking about sustainability, is that he says in the book he visited Joel Salatin's farm because Joel Salatin refused to FedEx him a chicken. He wanted to taste his chicken. And so instead he drove down to the farm. I guess he flew over probably from Berkeley to Virginia and then drove down to the farm. Uh-huh. So the amount of oil consumed in the trip was...
I know.
and even those, you know, he then says, well, Salatin doesn't send his chickens around. He says consumers have to come to him. So even if the consumers are only coming from a 50-mile radius, mm-hmm. If they're driving their individual vehicle 50 miles to pick up a chicken and take it back again, the sustainability of the actual chicken production becomes yeah. irrelevant compared to the amount of fossil fuel they used in that journey.
And I think as we get nearer to this this oil shortage crunch, more of these subtleties are going to start to appear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then talk about real localism.
Right. So we looked at the question of buying local food in the book, and you know, on the whole, we support the idea, but we think, again, you need to look a little bit behind the scenes. Our family of conscientious omnivores in Connecticut were buying locally from a family-owned farm that had been in the area for centuries. And when they were buying vegetables in season, that was good. They were saving the fossil fuel from the journey of that most food in America travels 1,500 miles on average. So that's good. But we then found that the farmer was growing early tomatoes, that is, earlier than they would normally be available in mm-hmm. Connecticut, mm-hmm. By putting them in a greenhouse and heating them with oil. And when we asked him how much oil he used and how many tomatoes he got out of it, and then compared that with known figures on how much oil it takes to truck a load a certain distance, we found that really you could just as well have trucked them up from southern Florida for the amount of oil it took to get them in early. So really when people say buy locally, they need to add and seasonally mm-hmm. if they really want to be doing some good in terms of, mm-hmm. of fossil fuel reduction.
So I suppose the ultimate in ethics would be to feed yourself, would you say?
Yes, certainly. If you've got a backyard and you can grow some veggies, that's great. I've done that a little bit myself. I've done some veggie growing, but...
Not all of us have a half an acre.
No, in fact, I didn't either. I couldn't claim that we were living off the land. We were just supplementing our supply with a little bit of a few veggies that I knew were organically and sustainably produced. But most of us can't do that, so we do have to rely on something else. And you know, certainly if we're living in northern latitudes, it's very hard to get food all year round. We would have to radically change our diet. And there's something nice about the idea of, you know, this is the first tomato of the season. We no longer think about that because we have tomatoes all year round. But of course, previous generations did welcome the first tomato of the season. It was particularly exciting and delicious. So we'd have to go back with that, but then we'd have a rather dull winter diet where there weren't very many fresh vegetables around.
Well, it's a much different consideration when you're in Southern California.
Yes.
Whether you're in Northern Ontario, whether you want to eat locally.
It's completely different, yes.
Yeah,
but in Southern California, the issue then becomes irrigation.
Mm-hmm.
And where does the water come from, and is energy being used to get that water to you, or is it drying up some of the rivers that it's being taken from? So there are still issues, I think, there.
So you're heading back to Australia soon?
I am, that's right, yes. I've pretty much finished this book promotion tour, and then I'll be back to Australia.
Well, thanks for taking the time to stop with us on your tour and talk to us on the politics of food.
It's great. It's obviously an exciting program that you've got there. Sorry I can't hear more of it, but it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, you can hear more actually on, we've got a website and I can send that information
to
you.
Oh, great. Yeah, email me the details. I'd like to see what else you're doing.
We've been speaking with ethicist Peter Singer about his book, The Way We Eat, Why Our Food Choices Matter. Thank you, Mr. Singer, for joining us today.
Thanks a lot. It's been great talking to you.
We're back, and you're listening to The Politics of Food. I'm Joy Hout.
I'm Nathan Callahan.
And you are?
Listening to The Politics of Food.
Oh, you are too?
Yeah.
Well, you should. It's a good idea. To continue our show today, we have a local rancher here in Orange County, California, that raises what he describes as sustainably farmed beef. And we're going to talk to him, and we're going to ask him about that. Let me get him on the air. Frank, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
How are you doing this morning?
Really good, and you?
Pretty good. Are you out on the ranch right now?
No, I'm actually sitting in an easy chair at home.
And where is your this land that you ranch?
It's in eastern Orange County. Actually, it's on both sides of Cook's Corner up Live Oak Canyon Road.
And how many head of cattle do you have up there?
About 80.
Now, you told me that you have a different genetic stock than most of the cows that we're used to eating if we eat beef.
Yeah, I have a purebred herd of Barzona cows.
What does that mean? What's a Barzona cow?
Well, it's a breed. It was developed in Arizona in the 20s. It's Africaner, Santa Gertrudis, and Hereford cross. And they've had a closed herd for 80-some years now. Anyway, they're a really highly adaptable, I call them a desert cow. Basically, they have a lot of environmentally consistent traits to them that make them do better outside, eating natural grasses and browse. They're real gregarious. They're kind of like sheep. They hang together. They're solid red in color. Their hair coat makes them more adaptable to the environment because they reflect IR rays. And they've got, actually, they're like a coyote. They've got two sets of hair. They've got guard hair and fur hair.
Now, this is not a breed you find very often. Why did you, I guess I have two questions. Why did you choose this specific breed? And is this something that we see very often on cattle ranges in the U.S.?
The answer to your second question is no. There's probably only 1,500 or 1,800 of these cows in the country. There's a lot of them. The analog to these cattle were developed by Dr. Jan Bontzman in South Africa, which actually backwards, we used a Hereford cow and an Africaner, Santa Gertrudis bulls, and they used the Africaner cow and the Hereford and the Santa Gertrudis bulls. But in this country, they're what you'd call rare. The way I got into this is I was taking a nutrition class at Cal Poly 30-some years ago, and we were balancing feed route rations, and part of the mathematics of this was figuring feed conversions, and I discovered that it took 32 pounds of grain to make a pound of lean beef. And this was right in the middle of the Vietnam War, and everybody was up in arms, and somebody had said on the media that 40,000 people a day were dying of starvation all over the world. And it seemed really stupid to me at the time to put 32 pounds of grain into a steer to make a pound of lean protein. So I decided when I was going to college that I was going to develop a herd of cattle that you could take from birth to graft and eat the meat. And basically, I looked around. I've actually toyed with several different types of animals, but these Barzonas, in my opinion, are by far the best. They eat considerably more browse than any other beef, domestic beef cow.
Oh, what was that word you used? What do they eat?
Browse, brush.
Okay. So how does this equation turn out differently? You know what? Well, I've seen your farm, as Nathan was saying. I visited your ranch and I saw that you're not feeding them in stalls. They're running around eating the perennials that you have carefully tended to on the land.
I didn't get the question.
Oh.
The cattle itself,
I'm not sure there was
one. They're actually just more environmentally adaptable. My genetic program, my selection gears towards the animals that can thrive and survive and actually gain the best in a natural environment rather than the animals that do the very best on, you know, store-bought feeds, grains, and additives. The biggest problem with the thrust of our cow industry is that we can genetically contrive animals that can convert this grain really, really efficiently into meat, but you're losing your natural adaptable traits, or your adaptability to your environment, I guess would be a better way of putting it. And you have to bolster them up with antibiotics and hormones, and you know, you have to use herbicides and pesticides on the feed and the additives that go into them. And my opinion is the whole industry is trying to drive a square peg into a round hole.
It seems that way. But
I mean, if you think about it, okay, if you're going to grow corn for cows, you got to get a tractor out, plow the ground, cultivate the ground, spray the ground, plant the ground, water it, wait for it to grow, run a harvester over it, put it into another truck, haul it to a feed store or a granary, crack it, roll it, and then feed it to a cow when you have the perfect animal to harvest it right off the ground.
Well, I think that that situation that you've just described is the bane of a lot of people in our society and people who have chosen to not eat meat at all. We just spoke to Peter Singer, who's an ethicist, who talks about the consequences of eating meat versus vegetables and other protein sources. So what you're saying is there's another way to raise cattle that isn't so destructive and illogical.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely, definitely.
Now, tell us a little bit about the land itself and how long you've been on it and what it was like when you first started.
Okay. Well, I practice holistic management, which is a body of knowledge that was discovered and, I guess, codified would be a good word, by Alan Savory. And when you get basically right down to it, what you're trying to do is mimic how the buffalo ran here 300 years ago. Okay, so all of this country has got I'm speaking specifically of Orange County. This is some of the very best soil in the world, but it grows coastal shade scrubs, oaks, and sycamores, and annual grasses.
Right.
And this is not a climax community. Matter of fact, when you get right down to it, most of the brush and all the grasses are European. When the conquistadors came here, the Franciscan fathers described this country as the land of milk and honey. It was big bunch grass, perennial grass plants. We had conifers on the hills, and we had oak trees and sycamores in the draws and creeks.
Now, do you know, Frank, if there were local indigenous ruminants on this land?
We had millions of elk.
Mm-hmm. So where have they gone?
We shot them, and we ate them, and then we turned our cows out and conventionally grazed it, overgrazed it, and ruined it.
So what was that land like when that was overgrazed where you are? What's it been like to reconstitute it?
It's a struggle because the soil fertility is really good here, and you have to have what they call animal impact. You have to really churn the ground up with the feet to get any change in succession here, which is why it's so difficult, specifically in these Mediterranean climates, to affect wholesale change. From the time I started to now, I probably got 25 to 30% perennials in the oldest fields. I've been there 7-8 years now.
Mm-hmm.
The new ones, you can't. The place where I took you, that you couldn't find a perennial grass plant on that ranch if you looked.
Right.
And I have. They're just non-existent. But by basically what the grass plant wants is time to restore its root system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, describe that, the cycle of a perennial grass, and why a ruminant is important for it.
Okay, well, in a healthy environment, you should have like 2/3 of your organic matter below ground and 1/3 above. Okay, if you dug all the roots out of one of these oak trees, it would probably come pretty close to being that ratio.
Okay.
All right. What happens when you conventionally graze cattle, wildebeest, caribou, any animal, if you put a fence around it and leave it in there over about 13 days, you overgrazed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, mainly because all these large herbivores are specific grazers.
Mm-hmm.
They eat exactly what they want to eat because they're trying to keep a 9.2% crude protein level in their rumen.
You think they're thinking about that as they're munching?
No, but they're instinctively picking it up because they do it, and they're right on the button every time if it's available.
And so what's different about what you do?
Well, what you do is, well, let me finish the entire story.
Okay, I'll stop interrupting.
If you conventionally graze them, you immediately start to overgraze. Now, what overgrazing is, the definition is when you have bitten an individual grass plant before it's had time to regenerate its roots. So what you have to do is get into a piece of country and eat it as intensely as you can, and then get out and let it rest and regenerate your root system. Now, this was done naturally by the predators.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the pack of wolves around a herd of elk, they bunched them, they drove them.
Mm-hmm.
The stragglers, they killed and ate, took what they needed. But in the meantime, the land was getting animal impact, intensive grazing, and at least a sufficient amount of, you know, animal impact.
Mm-hmm.
We were chiseling the ground, resting the ground, and eating the ground. Environments, there are no environments on this earth that are at rest.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is just like us, getting up in the morning, going to work, and trying to make a living.
Well, talk to, when I visited your ranch, you mentioned the role of bacteria.
Oh, well, bacteria grows grass and humans and everything else on earth. If you get right down to it, bacteria is what I actually grow.
So explain that.
Well, the rumen of a cow is a big fermentation vat.
Okay. That's a nice thought.
What's that?
I said that was a nice thought, but go ahead. Right.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nothing on earth, nothing gets any value out of cellulose except bacteria.
Hmm.
There's bacteria, the smallest organism we got is the one that eats the hardest compound to digest. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So a cow puts all this grass, green or dry, in her stomach. The bacteria, the normal flora, changes with the natural change in the grass. I mean, there's complex carbohydrate digesting bacteria, and then there's more simple carbohydrate digesting bacteria, and there's a balance in there. And as the feed changes to dry, you get more of the complex carbohydrate digesting bacteria, and the cow goes right on with eating. The cow eats grass. This rumen digests it in this bacteria vat, and actually the cow lives on the waste products of the bacteria itself.
Hmm. So that's his fuel.
A what?
That's her fuel.
Yes. I mean, she doesn't get any value out of the grass she eats at all. If the bacteria weren't there to digest it, she would starve to death.
So then what does this have to do with the like the cycle for an omnivore like us? How does that the beef affect us?
Well, we can't digest cellulose. Okay, my big line with vegetarians is I'll give you a knife and I'll put you in any environment in the world, and if you can survive for 3 months, you can be a vegetarian. But without technology, vegetarianism can't exist because you have to kill something to eat it because it's the only source of protein that you can eat without modern technology.
Now, Frank, I want to remind everybody we're talking to Frank Fitz. See if I can screw that up a little more. Frank Fitzpatrick. He's a local rancher here in Orange County, California. Frank, now how is what you're practicing now, how is that different from what you learned in your agricultural studies in school? You have an agricultural education, don't you?
Right.
How is this different?
I don't know. I mean, it's like they taught how the world was flat, and this guy teaches how the world's round.
So it's pretty different.
Right.
Well, what inspired? Well, you talked about, you know, you started to do the numbers, but is that the only thing that started you on this in this direction? I mean,
I think that was the epiphany. Mm-hmm. When you get right down to it. I mean, I was an 18, 19 year old boy looking for something to do in life, and at the time, it seemed like a good thing to do.
And what's been the reception from purchasers and you know, consumers?
Really good. People like the meat. It's tasty. I don't sell steaks because they're tough and they're expensive.
Now, what is sometimes consumers have noticed that, like you said, they can be a little tough. Is that because they're grass-fed and we're kind of used to a grain-fed sweeter
meat? Right. Well, grain-fed beef, what you're trying to do is get interstitial marbling. So you're getting the fat, the white fat inside the cells of the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that breaks the muscle fibers or separates them,
mm-hmm.
and it makes them tender. And the more fat you got in there, the more tender the meat is.
Right.
But it's all 6 omega fatty acids, and it's all no good for you.
Right. Well, you're talking that's in a conventional cow.
In a grain-fed steer,
right.
Yes.
Right. So, and when I thought about that, I thought of all of the the sugar and corn and stuff that I eat.
Right.
And I thought about the inside of my muscles.
Right.
And I have this idea of myself now as fairly marbled.
No, you're not.
So you're saying that a grass-fed animal is far less marbled, and so you end up with a texture that's a little more sturdy.
You get very little marbling in them.
Okay, right.
Okay. When you get right down to it, if any animal on Earth, if you feed it more sugar than it can turn into glycogen and use for energy, it makes fat.
Right, right.
Okay. So, I mean, that's sugar is our nemesis. When you get right down to it, we've seen the enemy needs sugar. Okay.
I'm going to go with that.
In all instances, I mean, from cigarette smoke to gasoline, really.
So, Frank.
I lost my thought here.
Oh, that's okay. Happens to me all the time. Nathan, do you have any thoughts?
Well, I'm still contemplating sugar as the enemy.
Yeah,
I'm wondering, though.
That's a good one.
You have 80 head, and you have how many acres of land?
About 720 under fence.
Okay. How big a herd could you raise on that property? Or are you maxed out at 80?
Pretty maxed, yeah.
Okay.
Now, I got to get rid of 40 in the next couple of months, or I'm going to be out of feed.
Do you think that if everywhere cattle were raised the way you were raising them, whether it could sustain our current meat-eating habits, or do you think people would have to cut down a little bit?
God, no. If the world turned to holistic management next week, grass would be 35. I mean, beef would be 35 cents a pound.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, get in an airplane and fly to New York and look down.
It's because of the amount of corn down there. What you're saying is...
I'm not talking about the corn. I'm talking about the desert, the land that we could reclaim and turn into grasslands.
Mm, I see.
That used to be grasslands? Or are you saying that the deserts could be made into grasslands?
They could be made into grasslands.
Okay.
Man makes a desert out of every place he's ever been.
And so this is much more efficient, is what you're saying, than our current system.
Well, it's more natural.
Okay.
Actually, what you're trying to do is do it the way it was done before man stuck his nose into it.
Well, we're still sticking our nose in a little bit. You said as we rode around in your pickup truck that you were behaving as the predator.
Yeah.
Kind of moving them around.
that's the job when you get right down to it.
Right.
and also the dad. You've got to move them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you got to create herd effect, animal impact, and rest. Okay, and these three things have got to be done in order for the plant to thrive, survive, and to plant new plants.
Okay, Frank, this is Frank Fitzpatrick, and we're on the Politics of Food. We are just about out of time. Thank you so much, Frank. That was a lot of great new information. So it's rounded out the show today.
Okay, next time we'll talk about three omega fatty acids.
Yes, I promise. We'll take a rain check.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Frank.
Bye.